Today, I must cast around for abstract expressions to describe what I love in the world, what I want to see preserved at all costs, and what must never be betrayed on pain of everlasting fire. Freedom and human wisdom, courage, grace, wit, and music. Even then, I'm not sure of being understood. Then, all that was needed was a single name, a mere nickname, Teddy, and I could be sure that, at least in our circle, everyone would know what I meant. We all loved her, the bearer of this name. An Austrian girl, slight, honey-blonde, freckled, lithe as a flame. For her sake we learned and unlearned jealousy, acted out comedies and little tragedies, felt like singing hymns and dithyrams, and we discovered that life is grand when lived with courage and wisdom, with grace and freedom, and with an ear for its humour and its music. Our circle had a goddess in its midst. The woman who was once Teddy may now be older and more earthbound, and none of us may still live life at the same emotional pitch as then. But that there was once a Teddy, and that we experienced those raptures, cannot be taken from us. It formed us more powerfully and more enduringly than any historical event. Teddy soon vanished from our midst, as goddesses do. She left for Paris in 1930, already resolved not to return. She was perhaps the first emigrant. More far-seeing and sensitive than us, she sensed the growth of stupidity and evil long before the advent of Hitler. Once, each summer, she would return to pay us a visit, and each time she found the air more stifling. The last time she came was 1933. Never afterward. By then, we, that indefinite we, with no name, no party, no organization, and no power, had long become a minority, and we knew it. That instinctive feeling of universal comprehension that had accompanied the numbers games one had indulged in, both of war and sport, had long turned into its opposite. We knew we could not talk with many of our contemporaries because we spoke a different language. We felt the tide of a new brown German rise around us. Words such as Einsatz, strike force, Garant, pledge, Fanatisch, fanatical, Volkgenosse, racial comrade, Schulde, soil, Artfremd, racially alien, Untermensch, subhuman. A revolting jargon, every syllable of which implied a world of violent stupidity. We also had a secret dialect. Among ourselves we summed up people in a word. If they were clever, which did not mean that they were particularly intelligent, but that they had some sense of an individual life, they were one of us. We knew the morons were in the overwhelming majority. But as long as Stresemann was there, we felt more or less sure that they would be held in check. We moved among them with the same unconcern with which visitors to a modern cageless zoo walk past the beasts of prey, confident that its ditches and hedges have been carefully calculated. The beasts, for their part, probably reciprocated this sentiment. With deep hatred they coined the word system for the impalpable force that held them within bounds while it left them their freedom. For the moment at least, they were held within bounds. In all those years, they never once attempted to assassinate Stresemann, though it would have been quite easy. He had no bodyguard, and did not entrench himself behind high walls. We often saw him strolling in Unter den Linden, an unremarkable, stocky man in a derby hat. "Isn't that Stresemann over there?" someone would ask, and indeed it was. Sometimes we might see him in Pariserplatz, standing in front of a flower-bed, nudging a blossom with the end of his walking-stick and contemplating it with his protruding eyes. Perhaps he was trying to remember its botanical name. Remarkable. Nowadays Hitler never shows himself, except in a speeding car, surrounded by 10 or 12 cars full of heavily armed SS guards. It is probably just as well. Rathenau in 1922 refused to have armed guards and was consequently promptly murdered. Stresemann, on the other hand, could gaze at the flowers in Pariserplatz, unattended and unarmed. Perhaps he was a magician after all, that broad, unprepossessing, unhandsome, unpopular man, with a bull neck and bulging eyes. Or was it just his unpopularity and insignificant looks that saved him? From afar we followed him with our eyes as he walked slowly and pensively down Unter den Linden into Wilhelmstrasse. Many did not even recognize or notice him. Others greeted him, and he returned the greeting politely, quietly raising his hat, not shooting out an arm, and to each person in turn, not to a vast concourse. We would ask ourselves whether he, too, was clever, and whatever the answer, we felt quietly confident and full of respectful gratitude toward the unprepossessing man. Nothing more. He was not one to kindle a flame. The strongest feeling he ever roused was by dying, sudden, cold horror. He had been ill for a long time, but it was not known how gravely. Indeed, one later remembered that the last time he had been seen, 4 weeks previously in Unter den Linden, he had looked paler and more bloated than usual. But he was so unobtrusive, we had not noticed anything special. He died, too, most unobtrusively, in the evening, after a strenuous day, while he was brushing his teeth before going to bed, like the most ordinary citizen. Suddenly, as one read later, he staggered, and the glass fell out of his hand. Next day the newspapers carried the headline, Stresemann Dead. As we read it, we were seized with icy terror. Who was there now to tame the beasts? They had, in fact, just begun to stir with their mad plebiscite, the first of many of its kind. In future it should be a criminal offence for any minister to conclude a treaty on the basis of the war guilt lie. That was the right stuff for the morons. Placards and processions, mass meetings, marches, and a gunfight here and there. The era of peace was at an end. So long as Stresemann had been there, we'd not quite believed it. Now we knew. October 1929. A vile autumn, after a magnificent summer. Rain and raw weather, but also something oppressive in the air that had nothing to do with the weather. Angry words on the poster columns, and on the streets for the first time, mud-brown uniforms and unpleasant physiognomies above them. The rat-tat-tat and piping of an unfamiliar, shrill, vulgar march music. Dismay in bureaucratic circles, violent scenes in the Reichstag, and the newspapers full of a creeping, never-ending government crisis. It was depressingly familiar, had the smell of 1919 or 1920. Was not poor Hermann Müller, who had been chancellor in that dreary period, once again at the helm? As long as Stresemann had been foreign minister, no one had worried much about the chancellor. His death was the beginning of the end.